Chapter 18. The six of them stood in the middle of the shuttle, crowded together, as Arbiter Oyun tried to talk them through his discovery. The ship's main display projected a three-dimensional image of the surrounding area, which Oyun manipulated with his attached workstation while he spoke. "These are the areas we examined today," he said. "I pooled the data that you so kindly collected for us there and matched them with some of my own findings from before. But then, Elith, thanks to your very helpful description of your experience, I filtered all of these using several manipulations and algorithms I developed during my work on my previous initiative."
"On Deepcutter?" Elith asked.
"No, I've never heard of that," the Arbiter answered, maintaining the obvious fiction, denying the existence of the Deep Cutter initiative while simultaneously confirming it. "But yes, that's one. Taken altogether, I was able to produce this model." He lightly swept his fingers across the interface of his workstation, and the imagery on the display shifted and rotated to show an isometric view of the land. The detailed terrain features melted away, leaving behind only ghostly outlines in green, something like an X-ray of the region. To the southeast, a small orange-yellow fireball blossomed underground, with wispy tendrils reaching out in all directions. From beneath the mountains, from within the peak, a shiver spiked its way through her spine.
"What is that?" Ames asked.
"I'm not sure, exactly," Oyun said, "but I guess I would say it's a rough approximation of what I might call something like a power source."
Elith flicked a glance at Varen. He was already looking at her and didn't seem surprised by the finding.
"But this isn't from raw data," Elith said, returning to the image.
"This is from your model?"
"Yes, correct."
"And how confident are you that your model is accurate?"
"Oh, all models are wrong, dear," he said, "but some are useful."
"What do you think it's made of?" Ames asked.
"I'm not even sure it's made of anything, Captain," the Arbiter responded. "We could go there and maybe find nothing at all, but then again we could go there and maybe our gifted friends would be able to sense something the rest of us could not."
Elith stared at the display, filled with dread by what she saw, and knowing she could no longer resist its summons. But she knew, too, that what she would find there would be nothing she'd encountered before.
"It looks like it's underground, though, and pretty deep," Ames said. "Or am I reading it wrong?"
"You are correct, Captain Ames. It does appear to be subsurface."
"So we can't actually go there, then?"
Oyun focused the map on the mountain range and expanded the image to reveal more detail. The green outlines that had previously been a tangle of confused lines clarified with the closer view.
"Please tell me those aren't tunnels," Ames said.
"I believe they're tunnels," Oyun replied.
"No, thank you," the captain answered, leaning away from the display and stepping back from the group. "The planet's been plenty busy trying to kill us here on the surface. We absolutely should not be walking down into its gullet just so it can swallow us without even chewing, especially if you aren't even sure there's anything there."
"There's something there," Elith said.
"How do you know?"
She held up her hand and waggled her fingers.
"Spooky word stuff."
Ames groaned, closed his eyes, and tipped his head back.
"What if those tunnels were made by a billion of those critters, like the one that jumped us in the woods? What if it's a hive?"
"Then we'll ask Subo to go first," Elith said.
"Captain, if you don't want to go, I understand, but I must."
He looked back at her.
"Hey, that's not fair. You know if you're going, I'm going. I'm just not going to like it."
"I don't suspect any of us will, Captain Ames," Oyun said, "but I do believe it's our best chance of finding something useful."
Ames walked back to the group and leaned closer to the display.
"Going to be a long walk to those mountains," he said. "I don't guess you want to wait until we get the shuttle back up and running?"
"How much longer will that take?" Oyun asked.
"Couple of days, maybe?"
"Then no, I figured," If we leave at dawn, Nieta said, we'll have enough daylight to make it there.
Yeah, Ames said. But what about back?
Nieta glanced at Elith and then back to Ames.
Yeah, he said. I figured.
Very well, the Arbiter said. We'll leave at dawn.
He shut off the main display and set his workstation aside, then stood to face the group.
I would be a fool to suggest I had any idea what tomorrow will bring, he said, but my instincts say that whatever lies ahead, we are at least on the right path. And after all we've been through together, I'm confident we can prevail.
Glad to hear someone is, Ames said. I guess we should set up shelters for the night, Nieta said. Are they outside?
Yeah, but don't bother, the captain replied. We've got enough juice now to keep the ship comfortable. Between the main cabin, the side cabin, and the medbay, I think we've got enough space to rack out in here. Save us the time and trouble of breaking camp and loading it up in the morning.
Sounds like a plan, Captain, Oyun said. Thank you.
Yep, Ames said. He looked around at each member of the group, sighed heavily, and shook his head.
You all look wrecked. If you're going to make me go headfirst into some bug hole tomorrow, the least you could do in return is try to look alert while we're there. I'll get the gear pulled together. Varen, you're sleeping in the med bay, no argument. The rest of you, figure out where you're bedding down and then go do it.
Ames, Elith said,
we'll all help prep.
I got it, the captain said, cutting her off as he started toward the hatch. You need to recover more than I do.
She followed after him. The man had been working nonstop since their crash, and she knew how hard the next day was going to be.
We all need to recover, she said. We can work together now, knock it out, and then together we can all rest.
I said I got it.
Captain,
no,
he barked sharply. He stopped at the hatch, placed his hand on it, and dropped his head forward. After a moment, he half turned to look at her, and then the rest of the team. He took a steadying breath.
Look, he said, calm and quieter. I'm in way over my head here.
Way over.
I'm just a guy. I'm not like the rest of you. Come tomorrow. I don't know how much use I'm going to be. Might be none at all. But this is one thing I can do. One thing I know I can do that will actually help. So please, just let me have this.
Elith stood in the middle of the shuttle, silent. She'd known Ames had been rattled. But now, for the first time, she saw how frayed he had truly become and got a sense of how long he'd been concealing his fear beneath a mask of good-natured humor and service to everyone else.
I will assist you, Captain Ames, Karush said.
Ames looked like he was about to argue, but he stopped when he realized the Azirim hadn't been making an offer so much as a statement.
Very well, Wari Karush. We'll see the rest of you at dawn.
Elith stepped to one side to allow Karush to pass, and the two men exited through the hatch into the gloaming. When it had sealed behind them, Uyun took charge.
Varen, as the captain said, you'll sleep in the medbay. I'd like to keep you monitored throughout the night, so we have a good idea of how recovered you actually are in the morning.
I feel fine, Arbiter, Varen said. A little snooze and I'll be right as rain.
Oyun made a face at the choice of phrase, and Varen flashed a quick smile to let everyone know it hadn't been an accident.
Nieta, Elith, Oyun continued, why don't you two take the side cabin? I believe the rest of us can find room here on the deck of the main cabin.
Neither of us need pampering, Elith said. Maybe you and Ames should take the VIP room, or we can draw names for it if you like.
Kind of you to say, but it wasn't meant as a chivalrous gesture. I have further work to do with the ship's systems. Karush will insist on sleeping by the hatch for security purposes, and Captain Ames will flatly refuse to take any space in that cabin. If you try to force him, he'll just sit in a seat out here all night in protest. You two are our honored guests, after all.
Well, I guess that's settled, Varen said. And though I do feel absolutely fine, I think I'm going to go lie down. Doctor's orders and all.
For all his commentary, he was still wan, and Elith noticed his hands were trembling.
Good, Nieta said. I didn't want to be the first, and I am feeling the toll of the past couple of days.
The group disbanded, and the two women retired to the side cabin. And though the quarters were tight enough to require some coordination, they hardly spoke as they prepared for sleep. Nieta maintained her emotional distance and avoided making eye contact. And Elith, with her new understanding of Nieta's true role on the team, knew that any attempt at light conversation would only give her away. Nieta knew her far too well. In addition to the cushioned bench, a more proper bed folded out from the bulkhead. Elith staked her claim on the bench, lying down on it while Nieta was washing her hands and face in the lavatory. Nieta paused when she stepped out and saw the bed empty, but made no comment about it. She switched off the light, leaving the cabin in near total darkness, save for two dim red safety lights over the entryway, like twin stars dying in the void. After Nieta had climbed into the bed, Elith lay silently, listening. 10 or so minutes passed, and she could tell from Nieta's breathing that the woman was also lying awake. Nieta, she said quietly.
Yes.
I know why you're here.
Nieta didn't respond for long enough that Elith assumed her former sister had nothing to say. But eventually, Nieta answered.
You should sleep. You'll need to be at your fullest tomorrow.
Elith woke to the gently rising glow of the interior lights. Nieta was still asleep, but now that she was awake, Elith could hear movement beyond the door in the main cabin. She rose and slipped out, finding Karush, Ames, and Oyun already suited up and working to make final arrangements. 6 large packs rested by the rear hatch, 3 to each side. None of them were packed quite the same, but the load seemed almost evenly distributed, except for one that was clearly lighter than the others.
That little one better not be mine, Elith said.
Ames glanced over at her and smiled.
Nah, he said. That one's for Varen. Get any sleep?
Plenty. How about you?
Enough.
Karush kept waking me up with all his snoring. That was Subo, Karush answered.
And though he said it completely deadpan, it certainly appeared as though he just made a joke. Ames and Elith shared a look of surprised amusement.
Karush, Ames said, you are a man of many hidden talents. I had no idea you had a sense of humor.
My efforts to keep to the way have sharpened many of my senses, Captain Ames.
Ames laughed and shook his head.
Wari Karush, joking around. I don't know if that's a good sign or a really, really bad one.
Nieta came out of the side cabin, and Varen appeared shortly after. When everyone was gathered, Ames pointed toward the forward section of the shuttle.
I got some goodies over there for each of you. Same things in every pile, and it doesn't matter what size you are. They'll fit.
Elith, Nieta, and Varen moved to the front to see what was there. Laid out for them were sets of soft armor of the same material as Elith's borrowed vest had been. These sets, however, were complete with an overjacket, pants, boots, and gloves, with the crimson and black markings of the Hezra. All of them felt oversized when Elith slipped them on, but just as before, once activated, the material cinched up snugly. She struggled a bit with the glove of her left hand. Though she'd regained some movement in her 2 outer fingers, she still didn't have complete control or sensation in them. No one else seemed to notice, though, and she did her best not to draw attention. A flattened, round-edged capsule rested on the upper back of the suits just below the neckline, about the size of Elith's hand.
What are these? She asked Ames, tapping the one on Varen's back.
Your hat, the captain answered. He pressed his armor along the collarbone, and in 2 seconds a helmet had formed, similar to Karush's. The faceplate was smooth, with no obvious openings, but when he spoke again, his voice was only mildly changed.
Try it out,
Two fingers, anywhere along your collarbone.
Elith pressed two fingers against her armor as instructed, and was quickly enshrouded. The interior of the helmet fit securely along her jaw and the sides of her head near her temples, but otherwise left a comfortable air gap around her face. From the inside, however, neither her vision nor hearing seemed affected, and she was able to breathe normally. She turned her head left and right, rolled her neck, testing the mobility. Though she felt some resistance, it was light, and certainly less than she'd expected.
"What do you think?" Ames asked, deactivating his helmet.
"Impressive," Elith said. She tapped her collar again, and the faceplate melted neatly away.
"Too bad it comes in the wrong colors."
"Yeah, well, looks good on you anyway."
"How come Karush gets the good stuff?" Varen asked, looking down at his flexible armor and then over to Karush's sleek, powered armor.
"Because he earned it, Varen," the captain said. "If you want to take the oath of the Aziri when we get back, maybe they'll give you your own suit in about 20 years.
"Nah," Varen said. "I'd never be able to stick with it. Too many rules."
"The way is not a set of rules," Karush commented as he checked the packs. "It is a direction. It leads us higher, but rarely does it instruct us where our next step should fall."
"Then how do you know where to go?"
"Because it also points away from certain things, and that list is easy to remember."
"Easy enough even for me?" Varen asked, his boyish smile starting to show through.
What had started as a gentle jab was turning to genuine interest, taking advantage of Karush's unusual openness. Karush paused his work and looked directly at Varen as he recited a litany of his way.
"Eyes that gaze down in arrogance, a tongue that crafts deceit, a heart that weaves wickedness, hands that shed innocent blood, feet that rush to cruelty, one who sows discord among the people."
Varen stood silent for a moment, absorbing the words, rolling them over in his mind, and Elith guessed, memorizing them for later discussion. Then he blinked and said,
Wait, remind me again, that was the list of things to avoid, or...
Karush stared at him a moment, and then wordlessly resumed his final check of their gear.
"We really should talk more, Karush."
"I disagree."
"If everyone is sufficiently equipped," Arbiter Oyun cut in, "we should get moving. We have a long day ahead."
"Breakfast?" Varen asked.
"Eat while you walk,"
Ames replied. He tossed a small packet over to Varen. From the size and shape, Elith guessed it was a standard half-ration. High-calorie, nutrient-dense, probably chalk-flavored. The team donned their packs and gathered as best they could near the hatch, though given their loads and the size of the craft, they mostly ended up in a crooked line down the center aisle. Oyun stood at the head of the group, with Karush next to the hatch. The Arbiter turned toward everyone, scanned their faces, undoubtedly preparing to deliver an encouraging speech.
"Let's try not to die before we figure this out," he said, and then he nodded to Karush, and the Azirim opened the hatch.
The ice-edged air that cut through the ship took them all by surprise, even more so the thin layer of sparkling white that covered the ground outside. Subo stood watch by the hatch, its head and shoulders frosted with snow.
Ames said. "That's quite a change."
The horizon showed the first tinges of color, hinting at a rising sun, and as the team filtered out, the ground crunched beneath each step. As far as they could see, snow hushed the earth and trees. The group fanned out from the craft, taking in the surroundings, judging the terrain, each attempting to account for the unexpected change in climate. The snowfall was no more than an inch deep, but Elith knew the cold and the extra care they'd have to take in their footing would sap their energy faster than usual.
"This is lovely," Varen said.
and I suppose we won't have to worry about getting overheated on our journey.
Well, great, Ames said. I hope our supplies didn't get all frozen up.
He crunched over to check on the various stacks, and the others maintained their positions while he did so. As Elith gazed out toward their destination, she couldn't help but feel that this drop in temperature was no natural phenomenon. Some 30 yards away, glinting specks of blue caught her eye, a speckled patch of colored ice fragments atop the surface of the snow. A few moments after she noticed them, they floated up off the ground, scattered and shimmering, and danced gradually toward them.
"Hey," she said, and pointed at the approaching anomaly.
"What do you think that is?" Nieta asked.
"Fairies," Varen said.
Subo moved forward 15 feet ahead of the group to intercept the colored lights. After a few moments, though, Elith recognized what it was.
"Butterflies," she said.
It was a small swarm, comprised of maybe 20 or 30, and though there wasn't much light yet, the delicate wings of the creatures sparkled and flashed a beautiful sapphire blue. The sparkling cloud approached Subo hesitantly, a few bolder butterflies slipping closer before retreating to the graceful dance of their companions.
"What marvelous insects," Oyun said. "I don't believe I've seen anything of their kind before."
As they watched, the shimmering swarm shifted from a nebulous cloud to take on a more orderly shape. For the briefest moment, they seemed to be mimicking Subo's silhouette. But they quickly returned to their scattered form and flitted away toward one of the supply crates nearby. Captain Ames stood a few yards from the crate, and the butterflies eventually wandered in his direction, pausing a few feet from him. They hovered there for 10 or 15 seconds.
"Yeah, okay, you're very pretty," Ames said, and then he waved his arm vaguely at them. "Now go away."
The crystal blue of the wings grew vibrant. The captain must have seen something in them, because he turned his head away and started to raise his arm to shield himself just before it happened. The cloud of butterflies vanished in a lightning flash of white-hot flame so intense that Elith felft the blast of heat from 10 yards away. Never before had she heard a human make the sound that came from Captain Ames. Subo was the first to react, covering the ground in what seemed like one step, and an instant later a thick white cloud billowed from its arm, coating the captain. Nieta rushed over, and Elith, stirred from her shock by the motion, followed her to the man's side. Ames lay on his side, quivering, making a strange half-whistling, half-whimpering noise. He was partially coated with white foam from whatever Subo had sprayed him with. But through the gaps, Elith could see the damage. The flesh across the entire left portion of his face was flash-burned and blackened. His armor smoked and appeared to have shriveled and buckled from the heat. The straps from his backpack had disintegrated completely, and the supplies inside popped and sizzled. Around him, the snow had vanished into vapor, and the ground steamed with the residual heat.
"Get him out," Nieta was saying. "Get him out of the armor."
The two women worked quickly to unseal the suit, but as they peeled back the front panel, his scream stopped them cold. Beneath, his uniform appeared to be melted against his skin. Subo swept in, scooped the captain up, and swiftly moved back to the craft. Karush was already through the hatch. Elith and Nieta leapt up to follow as Subo rushed Ames to the medbay. But when they reached it, the Azirim refused to let them in.
"Out!"
he shouted.
"Stay out!"
The last view they had before he sealed the door was of Subo laying Ames onto the bed and the captain writhing on it. Chapter 19.
"Is he going to make it?"
Elith asked, the instant Karush appeared at the rear hatch. His expression told nothing.
"I don't know," he answered quietly. "He is stabilized. There was sufficient material to dress the worst of his wounds.
The next 4 to 6 hours are critical to see if the artificial grafts hold and if he can withstand the trauma. But if he fights, he could survive. It had been an hour and a half since the attack, and the horrific injury Ames had suffered seemed to have ripped the heart out of the entire group. They all stood gathered around the rear of the shuttle, waiting for news.
Subo was quick, Karush added, and his pack shielded a good portion of him. The two together may have saved him.
Eleth nodded, and the group stood in awkward silence, uncertain what step to take next. The Arbiter didn't let the moment last long.
We should get underway, he said.
What? Nieta said sharply.
We've lost time. That will be difficult to make up.
We can't go now.
We cannot stay here, Nieta, he said, kind but firm, or there will be no one left to go.
But what about the captain? We can't just leave him here.
No, we cannot, the Arbiter agreed.
The remaining team members glanced around at one another, but it didn't take long to draw the obvious conclusion. After a moment, Nieta nodded her head.
Is there a way I can track your progress? She asked.
Oyu nodded.
Each of our suits has a unique signature registered to the shuttle. You can follow us on the navigation display.
And Ames?
Monitor him, Karush said. Encourage him.
Nieta beheld the faces of the other team members, slowly, each in their turn, and Eleth recognized what she was doing. She and her sisters had often done the same whenever one had been deployed. Weighing the moment, giving it its due, locking in memory the image of each in case it was the last time she looked upon them. When her eyes at last fell upon Eleth, Nieta held her gaze for a time, and then gestured to the others.
May I have a moment with my sister, she said.
The three men quietly moved off to give them some space, and Nieta dropped her eyes to the ground and walked closer to Eleth. She stopped about arm's length away, inhaled deeply.
You said you knew why I was here, Nieta said.
And when we first arrived,
yes, I was prepared to fulfill my duty to the house and to the Ascendants, to take your life if necessary, and if I proved capable. But now, I don't know what to make of you. They say you have abandoned the first house, but in our time here, I have only seen you uphold the best of it.
Eleth reacted to the statement, and Nieta looked up at her. Not as we were taught, perhaps, but I think, maybe, as we should have been. It was an astonishing declaration.
Nieta, Eleth said,
all this time I thought you despised me.
Nieta shook her head.
All this time, I've been wrestling with who you are compared to who I thought you'd become, who they told me you were.
She reached out and took Eleth's hands in hers.
You can do all that I can and far more. I think maybe you have surpassed even the greatest of our house.
My hope now, Eleth Kyriel, is that you are enough to save it.
It was only the second time since their reunion Nieta had dared to utter her name. But now, she magnified the moment by speaking Eleth's former hidden name, an action tantamount to reinstating her within her order. Her hidden name was granted by the house and known only to a precious few, and Nieta was precious to her.
Nieta Valinel, Eleth said, embracing the woman. My strength and my shield.
The phrase was a play on words, capturing the essence of Nieta's hidden name, but with the warmth of a pet name. In their time together in the house, Nieta had served as her instructor, her training partner, her caretaker, and her guardian during her recoveries. In their shared embrace, all those roles intertwined, as though all the sisters of her former house had joined in that one woman. And Eleth felt strengthened, comforted, and charged with a solemn duty. Nieta pulled away from her, placed her palm gently and briefly on Eleth's forehead, and then backed away.
Sarath Hanan be your guide, Nieta said.
Sarath Hanan be our way, Eleth answered.
They shared a final look, and then Nieta turned and headed back toward the shuttle. Eleth watched her go a few moments longer, strangely warmed by the interaction, but also touched by a vague guilt at having so misread her sister's intentions. She couldn't help but wonder what time she may have lost, if only she had pursued Nieta's presence rather than leaving her to her own isolation. The others had already donned their packs and were clearly anxious for her to join them. Eleth hoisted her gear and buckled the straps around her while she crossed over to them. When she arrived, Karush held something out to her, gunmetal gray and about the size of a large egg. "What's this?" she said, receiving the device and studying it in her hand. It looked vaguely familiar, but she couldn't place it.
"The captain's dragonflies," Karush said. "He wanted you to take them, for the tunnels."
She looked up to ask when or how Ames had told the Azurim that, but he had already turned away, moving to take the lead headed toward the mountains, with Subo falling into step alongside him. Eleth returned her attention to the device a moment longer. The captain's last effort to be useful, to help guide the way. She clipped the dragonfly pod to her belt, hoping she'd have the chance to thank him. And she moved out, catching up with the others to cross the wide clearing that had been beaten to a marsh just the day before. Now, with the light layer of snow, it felt more like a meadow beneath Eleth's feet. They kept a good pace, focused now more on covering ground than moving with abundant caution. Though everyone maintained their alertness, Eleth got the sense that they'd all come to accept that Quell's shadow had too many ways to hurt them to meaningfully predict or adequately protect against. This time, the journey felt less like walking through a minefield and more like crossing open ground in a sniper's known territory. Either they would make it or they wouldn't, and there seemed to be very little they could do about it. The path they'd followed the day before had been a spline, curving and sweeping through the denser parts of the wilderness, where the range of biodiversity was likely to be highest. Now they made as straight for the mountains as they could. The forest ebbed and flowed along their way, often opening up into sparse patches that were graciously easy to navigate, and the snow thinned quickly to the point that it became only an occasional highlight under broad trees or along shaded ridges. Arbiter Oyun remained in the rear, and though Varen had started out just behind Karush, he gradually drifted back to walk alongside Eleth. He made it almost a whole hour before he started talking.
"I'm a whole lot sorer today than I expected to be," he said,
rolling his shoulders beneath the weight of his pack.
"Guess I'm getting old."
"Or," Eleth said, "maybe you were in a shuttle crash yesterday."
"Oh, yeah. Guess that might do it, too. I didn't really get hurt that much, so I kind of forgot about it."
"First crash, huh?"
"It wasn't yours?"
Eleth gave him a look, eyebrow raised. He'd been the cause of her first one.
"Oh, right," he said, and grimaced. "Yeah, so how'd this one compare?
Other one was worse."
"Glad I wasn't there for that, then. And, you know, sorry about that."
He looked up, surveyed the sky above them, then scanned the surroundings, taking it all in as though he were seeing it all for the first time. After a deep breath, he shook his head with a wistful smile.
"It's hard to contemplate that we come from a race that was once planet-bound," he said. "I wonder what it would have been like to stand on a world, believing yours was the only sunrise, the only sunset, the only sea or shore that anyone would ever behold. Can you imagine that?"
"Not really," she said, hoping not to encourage him further.
"Not much of one for imagining, I suppose."
Eleth shrugged.
"It's our history," he said,
peering at her with intention. No matter what she did, he was going to draw her into a discussion, or at least drag her along with him while he monologued.
"The one we decided to write down, yes," she said. "You don't believe it?"
It makes for a nice origin story, if nothing else, celebrating our great ascension and all that.
Not that in particular, I mean history.
I believe it's lessons, she said. Varen leaned closer, eyebrows raised, expectant. Elith sighed and continued, It has a very long arc, and that's a good teacher. But no one can see history when they're in it. People are blind to the true significance of the events of their day. And later, they tend to imbue past events with whatever significance they need to fit the story they want to tell, to say nothing of the forgotten stories of those crushed under its weight.
Huh, true, in general, but not in specifics.
You know, Grief, the main reason I put up with your lectures before was because I was trying to figure out what you did to Quell, not so much because I actually found you interesting.
You always were the wiser one, he said, chuckling. But a rambling fool may prove wise if he rambles long enough.
He delivered that comment as though it were the pronouncement of a philosopher, but then bent closer to her, winked, and added,
That's just statistics.
Mercifully, he fell quiet for a time as they navigated a denser part of the wood. But when it opened out again, he held out a hand, gesturing at the landscape around them.
Do you think anyone in the future will believe any of this happened?
I'm not sure I would believe any of this happened.
Indeed, he said.
He paused to produce something from a pouch on his belt and added,
That's what makes this such a good idea.
He held the item up between his thumb and forefinger for her to see. It was the vial she'd given him with the remaining soil from Quell.
It's good to keep mementos on hand, tangible reminders of what once was, he said.
He held it up to let the sun filter through it, gazed at the earth within. Then, as he slipped it back into the pouch, he continued,
Our faith in the past tends to be weaker than our memory of it.
They passed under a large tree with drooping branches, the lowest of which dangled its long cedar-like needles an arm's length over their heads. Varen reached up and ran his fingertips along the greenery.
I've often wondered how long it took our ancestors to first notice the stars, he said.
Elith shook her head. We'd be incomprehensible to them now, except maybe as gods.
Perhaps, Varen said with a quiet chuckle, if we were but wiser. As it is, I suspect they would realize very quickly that we are still very much the same.
Elith let out a single scoffing laugh. Wow, Grief, even for someone as prone to wild exaggeration as you, that's quite the claim.
He shrugged. We know how things work to a greater degree of precision, I suppose. We have greater command over our environments. Certainly we know more of our stars and planets and moons.
But just because we can touch them doesn't make us fundamentally superior to our ancestors.
Oh?
Not superior to a planet-bound people who busied themselves with killing each other over resources they only thought were scarce because they didn't know to look at the vast abundance just beyond the borders of their own fragile little atmosphere? Varen smiled to himself as she spoke, but amazingly didn't say anything.
What? Oh, nothing. It's just hearing you talk about abundance like that.
What about it?
It reminds me of a conversation we had a while ago.
I don't know why I bother talking to you, she said. You obviously have some point you're enthralled with. Why don't you just state it instead of pretending we're having a conversation?
Oh, Elith, come now. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings.
You're not hurting anything but my ears.
I'm not enthralled with any point. I would just argue that our ancestors weren't killing each other over bits of dust. After all, these were the same people ingenious enough to create the means to cross every horizon they ever saw. They were constantly seeking out the unknown and confronting it. But it seems to be our nature to seek first to destroy rather than understand. So in that light, I don't think much has changed at all.
Now that she saw where he was really trying to lead her, she cut straight to the heart of it.
"We understand this place just fine, Grief. It destroyed Quell. We know all we need to know."
"We know all we need to know," he said, raising his hand and making a circle with his fingers around a tiny patch of sky.
"I wonder if our ancestors ever spoke those very same words."
After a moment, he spread his fingers, like a magician making a coin disappear, and added,
"Even when we lived on a tiny speck in the middle of nowhere."
Varen went quiet after that, but kept pace with her, not quite lost in thought, but not fully present either. Finally, she did some probing of her own.
"I still don't understand what's going on between you and this place, Grief."
"I don't either, exactly," he said. "But then, I tend to be more of a feel guy than a know guy."
"Tough to tell from the way you act."
"Friendly?
Like the rest of us are always behind, trying to catch up to some grand vision of yours."
"Yes, well, if I weren't eccentric, everybody would think I was crazy."
"That's just a nicer way of saying the same thing."
"Indeed," he said.
His brow furrowed then, and Elith recognized the dark edge, reminiscent of the mood that would overtake him on Quell.
"It's as it was before, Elith. There is purpose here. I don't know how else to describe it. You must feel it, too. Don't you have the sense that all that has happened up to now was leading you here to this place?
All I sense is that I'm here now, and that I need to do the thing that's right, given where I am. That's all I'm trying to do."
"Then we're operating the same way. Maybe I just interpret it differently. But I don't think I could have ended up anywhere else, other than right here, right now.
So I feel that my destiny is bound up with this place, Elith. It's no accident we're here, you and me together. We have important work to do, and it isn't just breaking this world."
"You're starting to put on your cosmic savior hat again," she said. "That's the part of you I like the least."
"Oh, there are parts you like more? The part where you quietly stare at nature without comment is pretty good."
"Wari Kurush," Varen called. "I believe your love of silence is starting to rub off on Elith here."
"I wish it would rub off on you," Kurush replied, without turning.
Varen smiled and shook his head, but the look that followed was shadowed once more.
"You're going to have to make a choice soon, Elith," he said quietly. "I hope it will be the right one."
He lengthened his stride for a few paces until he'd resumed his position between Kurush and her. And though the abrupt change of demeanor was concerning, Elith became more worried about his continued silence for the remainder of their travel to the foot of the mountains. The rolling terrain grew gradually steeper, the air colder, and the mountains more imposing. A light snow dusted treetops and outcrops of rock, and the clear sky felt sharp and empty above Elith, as though the path of her team lay bare and exposed to the pure vacuum of space beyond. As the day waned, they pushed even harder and took fewer, shorter breaks, and though they were all sweating heavy and breathing hard, no one complained or lagged behind. The closer they got to the range, the more difficult it became to be still. It was irrational, but pausing to rest did nothing for Elith other than make her feel like an easier target. The others seemed to feel it too. They were all growing more anxious under the uneasy sense that the planet knew they were coming and was just biding its time. They capped a ridgeline with a few trees, close enough that Elith could scan the range with her monocular and get a good sense of what lay ahead. Their entry point lay lower down the mountain, but within a slope that was neither gentle nor inviting, and though the ascent wasn't steep enough to demand actual climbing, the snaking, debris-littered pathways defied any hiking approach. From the ridgeline, they spotted a rounded rocky hill that marked the perimeter of the range. It was bald on top and appeared to roll down the opposite side into a saddle before beginning its rise into the mountains proper. Elith recommended that they make camp there for the night, and though they could have pushed on a mile or two farther before they ran out of light, no one argued. When they reached it, Karush and Subo took a quick patrol of the area while the others set up their shelters in a tight ring. As dusk draped its soft shadow over the landscape below, the group ate with little conversation, speaking mainly of logistics and ignoring any thought of discussion of what might come with the night. The truth, of course, was that they were no more in danger on that hilltop than they'd been at any other point since they'd landed. But that truth was hard to experience as darkness came. Before Elith retired to her tiny shelter, she found a spot removed from the camp and ran through her moving meditation sequence, drawing on its calming and restorative familiarity as an antidote to the knife-edged, alien energy of the wild. As she finished, she held the final position and gazed out over the landscape spread out below her. She loved the pristine, hidden places of Ascendant's worlds. The rolling, flowing wilderness gathered before her would have seemed warm and inviting, full of life and promise on any other planet. But for her now, after all she'd seen and experienced on Quell's shadow, it was like looking at the corpse of a loved one, an empty shell, drained of everything that had ever made it lovely. When she returned, Oyun had already disappeared into his shelter, and Varen was kneeling by the front of his, preparing to enter it. Karush walked the near perimeter, performing a final check as night closed in, probably for his own peace of mind. Subo stood just outside the ring of shelters, its configuration larger and more menacing than usual. Whether it was actually in a higher state of readiness, or Karush had set it that way for appearance only, it did give Elith some sense of security to know the machine was on guard. Varen glanced up as she approached, gave her a tired smile. He was pale again, and his eyes seemed hollower than they had earlier in the day. "You must be pretty beat, Grief," she said. "I think that's the longest you've ever gone without talking." He nodded.
"Hope you enjoyed it," he said, "because tomorrow morning I'll be right back at it.
You're assuming we'll make it to morning."
"Ever the optimist, Elith. Thanks for that. I'm sure it'll help me sleep."
They both lingered for a span, just looking into each other's eyes, each searching out whatever thoughts or emotions they could find in the other. Varen broke first, gave a little nod.
"Good night, Elith."
"Good night, Grief." He crawled into his shelter and sealed it behind him. Elith remained near it a few moments, reflecting on their earlier conversation, his change in demeanor, and his last words to her about having to make a choice. Whatever it was he foresaw, she guessed the moment would come when they reached the heart of the mountain. Before then, she'd have to make another effort to delve in and see if she could uncover what was in his mind. Undoubtedly, the next day would be one of revelation. Karush returned as Elith was crossing to her own shelter. "How's everything looking?" she asked.
"Quiet," he said.
"I wish I could take that as a good sign."
"If it takes us, it will be without warning. Perhaps there is comfort in that. For those at peace with their lives, at least. Will you sleep?"
He nodded.
"Soon."
Elith touched her heart and bowed, a sincere gesture of respect and gratitude. "Thank you for watching over us, Wari Karush." He returned the bow.
"Rest well."
Elith awoke and crawled out of her shelter into the frosted air, thinking she was the first of the team to arise. But when she stood and stretched, she discovered Varen sitting a little way off from the camp. She walked softly over to him, careful not to disturb him. He was sitting cross-legged, facing the dawn-grayed terrain below. He wore his regular clothes, not yet having put on his armor, and she wondered just how long he'd been out there. There was enough light to make out the contours of the landscape, and the contrast of light and dark between spreads of open ground amid patches of forest gave the scene a soft, quiet aesthetic.
Elith came up behind him, but he didn't react to her approach, and she was hesitant to speak into that sacred silence. For a time she just stood, looking out over the same sweeping view, absorbing it, and wondering what Varen was taking from it. And though the scene appeared tranquil, she felt an unsettling quality within it, different from the lifelessness that had disturbed her the night before. She scanned the full horizon again, slowly from left to right, but there was nothing that caught her eye as out of place or rose in her conscious mind as an obvious source for the unease. Elith glanced back at the camp to get her bearings and looked again at the landscape. It still took her a moment to grasp the fact that she was standing in the same place where she'd performed her meditation the evening before. And recognizing that, she realized that the terrain had completely transformed as far as she could see. "Grief?" she said. "It's all changed." He didn't respond to her at all, didn't even stir at the sound of her voice. "Grief?"
"Elith," he said, and his voice was burdened with emotion. She stepped up next to him, looked down at him. "Elith, this is where I was born."
He continued to stare out over the hillsides, eyes shining with a mix of joy, disbelief, and overwhelming memory, the face of a long-exiled man who, beyond all hope, had returned home.
"I mean, it's not really where I was born, I know that," he added. "But this landscape, this horizon, I spent my childhood staring at this view, dreaming of all that lay beyond it."
He turned to her then, and though his eyes fixed on hers, there was a distance in them that unnerved her.
"I wish you could have seen Markov, Elith. I wish you could have seen what it had been before I ruined it, and what it could have become if I had not."
"Grief," she said. "What did you do?"
"Nothing," he replied, looking back over the hillscape. "But I think maybe you were right when you said connecting with this world might let it get into my heart. It did. When I stood in that storm, I saw it, Elith, and it saw me, and I think maybe this is its way of telling me I'm in the right place."
Elith shook her head. "This world is a lie," she said. "It's not even a world, Grief.
Not as we know them, perhaps. That doesn't make it evil."
"Listen to your own words. Listen carefully to what you're saying. We didn't come here to settle down and make a home for ourselves,
and maybe that's why it's reacting the way it is," he said, getting to his feet.
He gave her a quick look, folded his hands together behind his back, then began walking slowly along the rim of the hilltop.
"I told you before, this planet was struggling with itself. I think maybe we're interfering." "It's not a planet. It's a device."
He stopped about 20 feet away from her, turned to face her.
"It's not important what it is, Elith," he said sharply. "What's important is what it could become. If we just take enough time. Quell is already at work in it. I can feel it. And you and I, the two of us, we can continue that work. We can shape this place, Elith."
There was no madness in his words or his eyes, but she saw that Varen was no longer completely himself.
"Is everything okay out here?" Karush said.
She glanced over at him. He was standing off to one side, near the edge of the camp, already in his armor, with Subo at his shoulder. And though his voice was calm, his stance emitted a taut, almost tangible energy.
"Just discussing the road ahead," Varen said. "There seems to be a mild disagreement between us." "There's no disagreement," Karush answered. "There is only what the Arbiter says."
"And what do you say, Arbiter?" Varen asked, his eyes shifting.
Oyun was there now as well, standing by his shelter. With Elith and Karush, the three of them formed a fan, with Varen the focal point of their attention.
"I say we continue with our plan, Varen," he said carefully, "just as we discussed."
You don't believe plans should be adjusted according to new information? Varen said.
If new information suggested such adjustment was necessary, yes. I don't believe we've determined that here, though.
Varen looked between the three of them and then gave a casual smile. But Elith saw the tension in it, how conflicted he actually was.
Have you told any of them, Arbiter? He asked. Or is that another secret you're still keeping?
I've shared all the relevant data I know to share, Varen.
Varen chuckled.
Relevant? I see. Elith, did the Arbiter happen to mention why it was that he was never successful with Deep Cutter?
Enough, yes, Elith said.
Oh, and what do you consider enough?
That the nature of space between galaxies is different from that within one, she said, and that you were helping them ask the right questions.
Not between galaxies, Varen corrected. Only between ours and all others.
He paused, waiting for her to understand, but she couldn't grasp whatever it was he was trying to imply.
It's a barrier, Elith. And you know how I feel about barriers.
Her mind couldn't hold the concept. How could a galaxy be contained? Even so, his face suggested what he said was true, or at least that he believed it to be true.
Arbiter, she said, is this true?
The Arbiter nodded, but didn't take his eyes off Varen.
Something created a barrier around our entire galaxy? Elith asked.
Or someone, Varen said. A wall to keep us in. Or to keep other things out,
Oyun answered.
We don't understand what it is, Varen. No one does, not even you. And it's dangerous to pretend otherwise. Either way, Varen said, speaking to Elith, whatever it was that we did on Quell to deflect the power of the contingency seems to have poked a hole in it.
We don't know that either, the Arbiter said. And Varen, you're starting to give me concerns.
Elith flicked her eyes to the other two men. Oyun maintained an easy bearing, not yet ready to exert his full authority. But she was alarmed to see that Karush had subtly moved his hand in front of himself, waist level, a half instant from the hilt of his dire weapon. She looked back at Varen. Surely he was aware of his great danger.
There's nothing to be concerned about, Arbiter, Varen replied casually, relaxed. You know as well as I do that this world came from beyond that barrier. I just wanted to make sure we all have the same information. After all, the quality of our information dictates the quality of our decisions.
He looked intently at Elith as he said the last sentence, testing her once more, attempting to peer into her thoughts. For a span, he just stood on the edge of the hill, facing them, placid. But then he must have seen whatever it was he'd been searching for in Elith's eyes. He let his gaze drop to the ground in front of him and smiled sadly to himself.
But this is where I was born, he said, and I don't think I can let you destroy it.
He inhaled deeply, and Elith saw his intent.
Varen, no!
But it was too late, and many things happened at once. Varen spoke a single, sharp word, and his voice sounded like a waterfall. A seam raced along the surface of the ground, and Elith saw Subo wrap itself around Karush an instant before it reached them. The force struck with the sound of thunder, and a dark spray erupted at the point of impact, like a wave breaking on rocks, throwing Karush and his machine some 30 feet, dashing them against the tree line. A broad gash in the earth marked where the Azirim had stood moments before. The ejected earth rained back down, and in the torrent there were glints of gunmetal gray. Subo's components shattered. She looked back at Varen in horror, paralyzed by the shock of the moment. He was staring at the aftermath of the destruction he had unleashed, mouth open, eyes wide.
and when he turned to her, she realized tears were streaming down both of his cheeks. He shook his head, though she couldn't tell if he was trying to communicate that he hadn't meant to do it, or if he was just sorry that it had come to this. And then a rift in the world opened between them. The ground beneath him gave way, and in the cloud of dust that billowed heavenward, he vanished.